separated institutions sharing the powers of government, that we are in fact confronted with exactly the danger of majoritarianism that Madison feared and that was a point at which we began the argument, meaning that bicameralism is even more important under these circumstances than it was when Madison was writing 200 years ago, but only in Leaphart's term, Aaron Leaphart, to whom Tony referred, only if the two branches are, correct me if I get this wrong, symmetrical and incongruent, meaning basically they have equal powers, but they are constructed in ways which encourage them to use those powers in different ways. What Madison had in mind when he said that they have different modes of election, different principles of action, and are as little connected with each other as the nature of their common functions and their common dependence on the society will admit. Full stop. Thank you very much.
Okay, that's fine. Bit of coordination required here. First of all, let me also thank John Muir for inviting me to this fascinating conference and for facilitating my return to Australia. I also welcome being on a panel with my good friend Stan, who is not only a good friend, but my eternal expert on congressional procedure.
You're in deep
trouble. As you can see, my title is Bicameralism, Strategic Interaction and Lawmaking Within the Contemporary Context, the U.S. House and Senate in an Era of Polarized Partisanship. The strategic interaction in contemporary lawmaking in Washington, or the strategic interactions, plural, are really complicated, so if I make it to the end of my presentation in the time available, it's going to be a minor miracle. The effects of bicameralism are all too evident in contemporary Washington politics. One only has to think back last year to the efforts of congressional Democrats to require the president to withdraw U.S. Troops from Iraq. The House of Representatives found it fairly easy to pass legislation that would set political benchmarks for the Iraqi government and the Bush administration. Unless the benchmarks were met, the president would have to redeploy U.S. troops from Iraq within 6 months and withdraw all of them by 2008. In the Senate, where the Democrats enjoyed a majority of only two, a coalition of almost all the Republicans and a few Democrats balked at confronting the president and demanding troop withdrawal. Not only, then, does it matter that a governmental system has two legislative chambers rather than one, it also matters what powers the chambers have in respect to one another, how each of the chambers is organized, and what the pattern of relations between the two chambers is. Bicameralism in Washington makes it highly likely that when major legislation is at issue, the House and the Senate will produce different legislative outcomes. This means, of course, that chamber, or more accurately, the leaders of each chamber, that each chamber has needed to adjust its political strategies to accommodate, to compete, or confront the other chamber. To understand how bicameralism affects the process of lawmaking in Washington, this means that we need to examine not only how each of the separate chambers behave separately, but also how they interact with one another. And this logic explains much of the structure of my paper. The main focus is on how heightened polarization and heightened partisanship in Washington, the mischiefs of faction of Madison, has shaped and structured contemporary bicameralism. Congressional scholars have really not given a great deal of systematic attention to the interaction between the different chambers. The most of the literature on the Congress is on the House, a little less or considerably less on the Senate, although that is being remedied very quickly. Most of the literature also tends to ascribe differences between the chambers exclusively to the Constitution and to organizational differences arising from different membership sizes, lengths of term served, constituency sizes and nature, and in the respective chambers' constitutional powers. Now, certainly these differences are real, and they lead to different legislative outcomes in the respective chambers, but with contemporary headlines in the newspapers such as Senate partisanship worst in memory, partisanship threatens Senate efforts to lower gas prices, and book titles such as The Contentious Senate, Partisanship, Ideology, and the Myth of Cool Judgment, a reference to Washington's conversation with Jefferson, apparently a description of the presumed role of the Senate. Any contemporary analysis of bicameralism in Washington needs to go beyond the Constitution to examine how contemporary partisan polarization affects how the chambers operate separately, as well as how they interact with one another, as well as with the president. So, the Constitution defines intercameral relations in Washington, but it doesn't do so exclusively. Although the Constitution stipulated rules for electing its members and how often it should meet, it enunciated formidable powers for the Congress, it says next to nothing about how the House and the Senate should be organized. No mention is made of political parties. No mention is made of congressional committees, the rules of debate, floor agenda setting, decision-making procedures, or the means by which the two chambers will reconcile their policy differences. Second, House members and senators have enjoyed almost complete freedom to develop their own organizational frameworks, their own internal rules and behavioral norms within their separate chambers. And it's hardly surprising that the two chambers have followed rather different organizational paths over the last 221 years. Most importantly, the House has developed into a majoritarian chamber, while the Senate is distinctly non-majoritarian. Little can happen in the Senate without unanimous consent. The Senate is run for the convenience of one senator to the inconvenience of 99, according to one senator complained a few years ago. The upshot is that the Senate party leaders, unlike their House counterpart, can't predict with great accuracy the content of a bill on final passage. As I said, the Constitution makes no mention of political parties. Yet, despite the supposed anti-partyism in American political culture, the constant hankering after some assumed common public interest and/or a political consensus, and the frequent portrayal of partisanship and partisan politics in American political life as little more than political posturing or maneuvering of public relations, political parties have actually done fairly well in American politics, particularly in the Congress, and no less so than in the contemporary period. Since the late 1970s, the US political system has been experiencing one of its strongly partisan phases, as the more conservative states, formerly solidly Democratic, have realigned to the Republican Party. Civil rights for African Americans has moved down the political agenda. As a result, each of the parties has become much more ideologically homogenized, and as a further consequence, has increasingly diverged ideologically from the other. As in previous periods, contemporary partisan polarization is rooted firmly in important electoral developments. Increasingly, polarized constituencies have produced greater partisanship in House and Senate decision-making, and stronger, more cohesive, and more highly polarized political parties. In this figure, which I hope you can see, if you can't see it, long way away. What this shows is that the levels of party unity, of the majority party, in both the chambers has risen considerably from round about 75% in the 1960s to round about 90%. In other words, the mean levels of party unity in the majority party are round about 90% now. And the percentage of roll call votes that pit a majority of one party against a majority of the other party has risen from about 50% over the same period to around 70%. So in other words, about 70% of the votes in the Congress pit the majority of one party against the majority of the other party. And as the parties have become more cohesive, they have become more ideologically polarized, and this is where you would have seen figure two, except I missed it out. And what you would have seen was a gradual divergence of the two parties over time to where we are now. Between the early 1970s and 2006, the gap between the two major parties on what we call, what congressional nerds call, a DW nominate score, which is basically a measure of the left-right dimension in the Congress, you see a gradual divergence between the parties. So, the Democratic Party has become much more liberal, and the Republican Party has become much more conservative over time. So the gap, the ideological gap between the two parties has increased significantly since the 1960s. Indeed, in the last Senate, the 109th Senate, from 2005 to 2006, partisan polarization, this ideological divergence between the two parties, was the highest of any Congress since the end of the Civil War in 1865. Polarization in the U.S. House was exceeded only by the Houses of 1895 and 96 and 1905 to 1906, which were also very partisan periods in American politics. The corollaries to these polarizing trends are that the number of centrists, those people in the middle of the ideological spectrum, have declined significantly since the 1970s. Most Democrats are liberals, most Republicans are conservatives. In other words, the party system is polarized. And you'll also see that the margins of victory between the, you'll need binoculars to see that, I dare say. What this shows is that if, from the period from around about 1990, the margins between the two parties in terms of electoral votes, in terms of their pluralities in the House and the Senate, have actually been very small. In other words, party competition has been very tight over this period. The current Democrat majority in the House is perhaps larger than usual, around about 30 or 33. But you'll get majorities in that period of only two or six or something like that. So the parties are very tight together. Increasing party homogeneity and partisan polarization has been consequential for congressional organization and major party influence and lawmaking. As a consequence of increased party cohesion and strengthened partisan polarization and leadership, party organizations are now the most significant decision-making units in the contemporary Congress, and especially within the majoritarian House. Crucially, it is the majority party in both chambers that is now much more likely than the minority party to set the chamber's agenda, to shape floor debate, enact its legislative priorities and preference, and, as in 2006, also suffer the consequences of unpopularity in congressional elections. The House, in particular, has over recent years acquired many of the majoritarian trappings of the British House of Commons, of the Australian House of Reps. That is, majority leaders don't seek the permission or the support of the minority party to schedule measures on the floor, and they decide unilaterally. And under recent Republican majorities in the House and a Republican president in the White House, the Speaker wouldn't even schedule a bill for consideration that a Republican president wouldn't sign. The Speaker shapes and structures the floor agenda to advantage his or her party, and he or she controls through the Rules Committee, which can write special rules which restrict the number of amendments which can be offered on the floor to major legislation. Today, almost 70% of rules are restrictive. That is, they limit opportunities of members to offer floor amendments. As recently as the mid-1970s, just 8% of rules were restrictive. Now it's 70%. And so on. The tight control which the majority party exercises over the floor is now greater than it once was. And, of course, votes on rules and agenda are all along party line. Now, although Senate parties have become just as homogenous as those in the House and partisan polarization has actually exceeded House levels, in the absence of the equivalent of Reid's rules, which really established majority party control over the agenda setting in the House back in the 1890s. Nevertheless, the procedural potential for strong party control is considerably less in the Senate. Senate majority party leaders can't even predict with great accuracy what procedures will govern consideration of a measure, when a vote on final passage will occur, or even the content of a bill on final passage. In all these matters, the Senate majority leader remains heavily dependent on his or her ability to reach unanimous agreement. Moreover, if push comes to shove and a filibuster is initiated, unlimited debate, then the majority leader will need a supermajority of 60 votes to invoke cloture. Given the tight party pluralities in recent Senates, no majority party has enjoyed a filibuster-proof majority for decades. Now, all this is not to say that Senate majority leaders and the majority party in the Senate are completely helpless in controlling the agenda. Over recent decades, they have devised several indirect methods of controlling the agenda, and there's considerable evidence to show how the majority party in the Senate has been able to influence the chamber's floor agenda, which all of which explains why Senate majority parties have been far more successful than minority parties in the Senate in winning final passage of their legislation. And also, it explains why the majority party has been able to secure its preferred outcome about 85% of the time. Not bad. What then? And we come finally to bicameral. What then are the implications of intercameral and interbranch relations of a majoritarian House in which the majority party can more or less insist on its preferred outcomes, and a Senate in which legislative outcomes are much less predictable, yet are nevertheless strongly susceptible to majority party influence in the contemporary context of heightened partisanship and polarization? Yeah. Okay. A priori, if the same party controls both the House and the Senate, and that party is homogenous across the different chambers and ideologically distant from the majority party, then we should expect the leaders of the majority party in both chambers to cooperate to present meaningful and commonly agreed legislative agendas, contra Madison. That we should expect the parties to coordinate their activities across the chamber. Conversely, when different parties control the different chambers, then we should expect conflict and agreement difficult. Second, we should expect the partisan affiliation of the president to influence intercameral relations. In the context of heightened partisan polarisation, if the majority party in both chambers shares the same partisan affiliation as the president, we should further expect cooperation and coordination to exist amongst the three institutions. Conversely, when control of the Congress is split between the parties, we should expect the president to cooperate and coordinate with the chamber controlled by his own party, but not with the other chamber. And as I showed in that table there, since 1990, while the same party has controlled the House and Senate for 16 and a half of the last 18 years, in only 6.5 years has the same party controlled both houses and the presidency. And the third factor we should look at is, of course, the Senate's distinctive features. We should expect the Senate's distinctive features, notably its supermajority requirement, its almost non-existent germaneness rule, and its demographic biases to affect intercameral and interbranch relations. That is, even when the same party controls the House and the Senate, we should anticipate that the two chambers might not reach agreement. And as I said, as Table 1 shows, no Senate has been filibuster-proof since 1990. Now, of course, there's a big health warning here that, having emphasized just these three variables in the context of heightened partisan conflict, I don't mean to say that other factors will not intervene. It obviously very much depends what the nature of the specific legislation is and what the wider political context is. Okay, then, assuming that unified partisan control of the Congress should lead to greater intercameral cooperation and split party control leads to greater conflict, what has been the pattern of bicameral decision-making over years, over the recent decades? And this is where I would refer to several tables, which, but I'm obviously, how much have I got? I should finish.
Three minutes.
Let me refer you to this. This is using the favourite denominate data again. And what we see here is three lines, basically. And I've got to try and figure out which one. If we look at the yellow line, the orange line, which you can just about see there, you'll see that the difference, that shows the mean position, in other words, the average ideological position of the chamber, both parties, okay? And that line shows the difference between the House and the Senate. And if you look at that line all the way across from the 1940s to the present day, you'll see it's pretty stable. And that's what you would expect. In other words, the difference between the chamber means are relatively stable over time, okay? But if you look another line, which is the green line, the turquoise line, the one that dips down at the bottom, this is the difference, the ideological difference between the two majority party means. In other words, the mean ideological position of the House and the Senate. Now, clearly, that makes a difference, and you can see where it drops down. That is an indication of the split party control of the Congress, where in the 1980s, when the Senate was in Republican hands and the House was in Democratic hands. In other words, the importance of party control of the Congress to intercameral relations. What I'm going to have to summarize very quickly here. What makes a difference in intercameral relations is party control of the different chambers. Also, what party ratios make a difference. That is, the majority enjoyed by the respective parties. Not just control, it's the size of the majority in each party makes a difference. And you can see that if you look at the black line, where if we measure the distances between the winning position, the winning ideological position in the House and the Senate, then you can see what difference party control and party, the size of a party majority makes. Now, I'm at this stage, I'm just going to cut myself off. There's a lot of information which I've not been able to give, which emphasizes the role of the interplay between the president and the respective parties, which makes a difference. If you have the system under total unified control, that is, one party controls the House, the Senate, and the White House, well, clearly it makes a difference. If you look at the kind of legislation which the Republicans were able to force through the Congress between 2002 and 2006, very different from the situation in which party control between the House and the Senate was divided, or the president was of a different party than one of the chambers.
Thank you, John. Yeah.
Sorry for cutting off mid-flow, but
well,
so you could some Guevara-esque speech prepared. You could have gone on for days. Ricardo, do you want to come up to the microphone? But before you ask your question, I am going to abuse my privilege as chair, my position as chair, by asking the first question. Primarily to John, but Stan, chip in, anybody else who happens to know. John, you're talking about the increasing discipline of the parties. What's been the driver for that? I mean, in a parliamentary system, it's usually thought of as the power of the party leadership, to, you know, the patronage power of party leaders, the ability to dole out front bench positions or committee chairmanship, and even, you know, as mundane things as overseas trips or whatever. And that's how people are kept in line. What's happening in the States?
Well, that's one explanation for increased party cohesion. Shared political values is another, that folks are members of the same party because they share political values. But ultimately, the increased polarization and the increased ideological composition of the homogeneity of the parties is electoral. And essentially, as I referred to it before, basically the South has joined the Union. So the Conservatives in the South, the southern states who formerly voted solidly Democratic, have now voted Republican. So you've got, to use a horrible word, an ideologization of the party system. But there's quite a debate within the literature. There's a considerable body of literature which shows that partisan polarization is heavily related to the increased equality in British, in American society. And that, there is also a lot of literature which shows it has to do with apportionment, how the representation in the House of Representatives in particular can be manipulated by state legislatures who are sympathetic to a particular party and so on. So there's quite a debate there. But I think the short answer is it's in the electorate. Okay. The electorate is polarized. Well,
Ricardo, if you don't mind, let me add a comment to that. I think it's probably not very helpful to talk in terms of party discipline when you're talking about congressional voting. As John said, what you're really talking about is party cohesion, voluntary party unity, because the party leaders in Congress really don't have much in the way of sanctions that they can impose on a member who goes wandering off. And who is it that selects leaders in the first place? Well, it's the members of the party in each house. And so they're going to select leaders who take them where they want to go or try to. And if you have a leader who says, follow me, and they turn around and most of their troops aren't following them, they're not going to remain leaders for long.
Ricardo, thanks for waiting.
Thank you. I have a methodological point that I want to make, and then I have a question for John. W nominate scores, and OC classification developed by Poole and Rosenthal are known to be time inconsistent, so it's not always appropriate to make comparison over time, nor to make comparisons between two chambers, because they might not compare adequately. In that respect, there's a piece in political analysis that points out why, from a mathematical point of view, that's not appropriate. But the second problem is, and that probably overestimates the polarization that you find, is that, as you know, when you apply these methodologies, all the votes in which there's an agreement between the two parties of over 0.9, those votes are not counted. So the heavy partisan votes are discounted. The heavily bipartisan votes are discounted. So you tend to inflate what you find. But leaving this aside, I tend to agree that there is polarization. But one issue that you have not mentioned is that after 1994, the Republican Party, with Gingrich first and then with Bush in the 2003 elections, has started a new strategy. They selected candidates, they trained candidates, they fundraised for candidates, and they found candidates that were ideologically aligned, something that was not the case before. And that probably is a factor for why in the past 14 years we might have an excess of polarization, at least on the right. So I would like to see your comments on that.
Yeah, I think there's a danger in overestimating the extent to which party leaders like Gingrich can recruit. If you are, and whether they're going to be all conservative, if you're trying to recruit a candidate in New York State, in some of the urban areas, the burbs of New York or Connecticut or so forth, where it's likely that a centrist rather than a really conservative is going to win or stand a good chance, you're not going to rely exclusively on recruiting conservative candidates. Your priority is, will your party win that seat? And it's the same. And if you look, therefore, at even Gingrich, who was quite pragmatic about this, when a centrist Republican was challenged in a seat by a conservative in the primary, then Gingrich was in there with the party machine discouraging the primary challenge, because he rationalized, took a very pragmatic view, that it was better to have a centrist and win the seat than have a conservative and lose the seat.
Yeah. So you will frequently have party leaders, especially in the House, saying to their own members, vote against the party position if you need to, because the primary concern is maintaining control of that seat in the next election and the election after that and so on for the foreseeable future. You know, if the price of keeping control of that seat is losing a vote today and perhaps another one next month, that's a price well worth paying. Let me add one other thing. I agree with John. There's another side to it. The percentage of seats in the House of Representatives that are seriously contested is really quite small. 435 congressmen and women will be elected next month, and there are maybe 10% of those seats that are truly in play. Most of them are safe for one party or the other. And knowing that, the real selection occurs in the party primaries, so that an incumbent or a candidate, in a sense, is looking more to the party constituency than to the demographic constituency, and the primary voters for both parties tend to be more the loyalists and further to the right for the Republicans, further to the left for the Democrats. So that tends to produce congressional candidates who have appeal to those wings of their party.
Richard. Sorry, before you ask your question, Richard, could you just say your name and affiliation? Sorry, I should have mentioned that after the first question.
Well, that's all right. I spoke yesterday. I was introduced. Richard,
I was thinking
Herr.
More for the
yeah.
record.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, Richard Herr, University of Tasmania. Just a question for you, Stan, of a historical nature. How much would your analysis change if the issue of factions was resolved for you by what the Founding Fathers were watching over in Britain, which is Sir Horace Walpole and the other prime ministers in the British Parliament, who dominated the Parliament, who gave the King the power to prosecute the oppressive legislation that they opposed, and that he was really talking about the factions and the factional structure of the British Parliament?
Over the years, Richard, I have come to admire a certain kind of answer to a question like yours, which is, I don't know. There are too many people who have made a career in Washington, including me, pretending to know answers to questions they don't really know. It's a very interesting question. I wish I knew enough about that period in American history and about British parliamentary history to be able to answer it. But
given that there weren't extra parliamentary factions or parties, mm-hmm. it just seems to be a much easier historical understanding of what the concerns were and the
About the only thing I can offer is that if you look at what Madison was writing, I recall very few, if any, references in the essays themselves to British political history. I think that would have been seen to be counterproductive for their purpose at the time, which, again, was to convince people to ratify this document for this new nation.
John Hart, and then John Summer, then Campbell. Sorry.
John Hart from the ANU. Can I take up, Stan, one point? I was with you all the way on Madison until you said Madison didn't contemplate the possibility of a faction taking control. If you go back to the theory of representation in the 10th Federalist, and I think this has an important bearing on the original nature of the United States Senate, there's one huge gap in the theory, and that is Madison never explains who the representatives are going to be. The theory starts out with the definition of factions and the explanation for the causes of factions, and Madison is quite adamant. The cause of faction is deeply rooted in human nature, and the cause is the various and unequal distribution of property. And in that sense, Madison is totally Marxist.
Well, if he says that is probably the primary.
He doesn't say probably. I think I take issue with you on page 11 of your paper where you say the, quote, unequal distribution of property may be the most common and durable source of fact. I think if you look at the 10th Federalist from memory, he says the most common and durable source of faction is the unequal distribution of property.
This guy is supposed to be my good friend.
and because of that, the whole of society is faction-ridden. If the whole of society is faction-ridden, how does Madison get to the position that he knows that one of the two advantages of a republican form of government is that under a republican form of government, you've got a chosen body of citizens who will refine the public views? And what he says, and again from memory, the phrase is something like a chosen body of citizens whose patriotism and love of justice will enable them to govern in the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. Mm. But nowhere in the Federalist Papers does he explain where these people come from. And the gap, I think, is important, and I don't think it's any fault of Madison. It's simply that the relationship between property rights and government was so well understood in the 18th century that you've got to see the answer in terms of people who have a stake in the land, who can see the national interest In other words, people like Madison.
Yeah.
And the Senate, it seems to me, fits in beautifully well with this. And, you know, I hate to say it, but the Senate seemed to be, at least as it was designed, a place where the property-owning aristocracy could counter the views of the masses expressed through the only directly elected body that was set up mm-hmm. by the Constitution, the House of Representatives.
Okay.
And even, of course, Madison didn't even trust that. I mean, he infiltrated the House of Representatives himself to, in his pre-presidential days in order to try and check the power of the mob there. So.
Yeah, John, okay. I think there's strength to your argument. I was looking for a quote from Joe Ellis, whose work you may know, in which he said that you know, both Madison and Hamilton, and all of them, were avowedly elitist. They didn't consider themselves to be Democrats, as we would think of that term today. Another thing to bear in mind, again, is what they're trying to do. And as a matter of political calculation, Madison may have thought, well, it's probably not a good idea to stress, you know, the kind of elitist institution that we expect to come out of this new constitution, even though most of the people at most of the ratifying conventions were folks of, you know, Madisonian wealth.
Okay. John, do you still have a... Okay, if you're sure. Campbell. Last question to Campbell.
Yep. Just to... my memory isn't as sharp as John's. I can't remember the words or whatever. But you're talking about the true preferences of Madison. Wasn't in the Virginia plan the Senate to be chosen by the lower house? That's just a point of information, or really a question.
I think you may be right. Do you recall, John?
It was to be chosen on the basis of population.
By population.
It was pretty designed. If Madison's preferences were those expressed in the Virginia plan, then Madison's sincere preference was for a pretty dependent upper house.
Sorry, could you come closer to the mic?
That if Madison's true preferences were expressed in the Virginia plan, mm-hmm. okay, which I'm not a historian, but that's my general impression, then his sincere preference was for a pretty weak upper house that was... was really not that powerful. That's a question. I don't know the answer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Response?
Mm-hmm. No. Oh, well. Also to Campbell. Please join me in thanking the speakers and the question askers and then tea.
Thanks, Sean.
No, thank you. Well,
Philip. already running late, so I apologise, and for that reason I'll be very succinct in my introductions. We're now on to the session of European Arrangements Old and New, the UK and Italy, which I find a fascinating subject. And our first presenter is Dr. Meg Russell. She is a Senior Research Fellow with the University College London, and she has done a major project on the comparative study of second chambers to inform the second stage of the House of Lords reform, which I find a fascinating thing to have spent some time doing. That's just a small slice of the work that she has conducted during her career. So, Dr. Russell.
Hello. Well, I was a little alarmed when I saw the name of this section of the programme, Bicameralism in Europe, Old and New, Britain and Italy. Let me put my thing up, actually, I forgot this. I think that probably makes me old and him new. And as some of you will know, because I've presented in Australia before and at other conferences some of you have been to, I've made it my work for the last few years to go around saying, actually, the House of Lords is not old. The House of Lords is actually rather modern and new and exciting. So here I find myself doing old. So what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about old and then a bit more about new in terms of the House of Lords and what all of that could teach us for bicameralism, particularly for Australia. One reason that I thought I would for once mention the old is that actually there is no avoiding the fact that in one sense the House of Lords really is pretty old. This is a quote from a book in the 1950s. It would be true to say that William the Conqueror founded the House of... It would be half true to say that William the Conqueror founded the House of Lords. Only half true, because what William founded was not wholly new, but was at least partly based on the old Saxon, I call it Witan, I'm never sure how to pronounce that, the meeting of wise men, which was already some four centuries old at the conquest of 1066. So I think by anybody's standards, that is pretty old. There are some slides on your handout about the old